Scramble for Africa series. Abyssinia, otherwise known as Ethiopia, which is actually in the news quite a bit these days, Dave.
Yes.
And some of the regions we're going to talk about, Tigray and, of course, Amhara, are what they're talking about in the news as well. Eritrea. So, Abyssinia. It's, you know, this is the place that escaped the scramble in some way, but it didn't exactly escape, did it?
No. No.
So we need to talk. Yeah, go ahead.
We're going back a fair distance here, back to the early 1800s. So pre-scramble and then during the scramble. So the story, I think, starts with Tewodros II, known as Theodore in the West, and I think that's what I'll call him because I'm not sure about how to pronounce Tewodros.
Yeah, I would have just said Theodoros, but who knows? Yeah, you're right. I don't know how to pronounce it.
He's a Coptic Christian who becomes emperor of Abyssinia.
Right, and Christianity is here since Christianity, right? Like it's as old a tradition in this part of Africa as it is in Europe. It's not like Christianity comes to Ethiopia from Europe.
Oh, no. No, it doesn't. So the country at this time, torn by civil war, it's known as the Age of the Princes. And that's because there is an emperor in Gondar, but he's a puppet. This is the Solomonic dynasty that goes, so far back. But by this time, it's a little bit like the situation in Japan in the era of Shogun. So you have strong men, these regional princes, who are from different ethnic backgrounds and slightly different religious backgrounds. So there's those tensions and themes in the fighting. And of course, they're struggling for control of the puppet emperor. So you get a new nobleman prince who gathers power and dethrones the puppet emperor and replaces another member of the imperial dynasty who will be their puppet. So different regions are taking turns controlling Gondar and, I guess, the reins of power and patronage and so on. So this young man, born Kasa Helu, or Hailu, in 1818 to a noble family, is born into this era.
Yeah, and apparently his father left his mother when he was two, and he was educated at a convent school in a town that was actually sacked by one of these princes. So he was moved with some relatives to a town called Kwara, where he learned to read and became interested in things like, eventually, Ethiopian warfare and European history. So
that's an interesting curriculum.
Yeah, well, the curriculum of a 19th century modernizer, I guess, or, you know.
Yeah, and instead of fire drills, you have the evacuate because an army's coming in to sack the town.
right, lockdown drills.
Yeah, so he began, Kasa began his career as a shifta, an outlaw, but he amassed a number of followers and was able to restore himself to his father's previous fief in Kwara, and then was able to dominate then control the province of Dembia. And he gained popular support because of an interesting tactic, benevolence. His treatment of the inhabitants of his province, well, according to Sven Rubinson, Kasa shared out captured grain and money to the peasants and told them to buy hoes and plant.
Right, yeah, I was reading about him in a book by Herbert Marcus about Menelik, who we're going to get to, and he said basically it's like a Robin Hood strategy, and it actually helped him build a kind of a political base in the region.
Yeah, and it makes you wonder, is this his nature or is this policy? Or both. He married a lady named Tewebek. She was the granddaughter of the Empress Menen and Emperor Johannes III. So this is moving up. This gave him more land, but the relationship apparently soured. He felt disrespected by the empress and emperor. So he rebelled in 1852, defeated the emperor's forces multiple times, and then defeated another rival warlord or prince. And he took the throne himself. So this is a little difference. Instead of putting a puppet on the throne, he crowned himself emperor in February of 1855. And that's when he took the name Tewodros or Theodoros II, attempting to fulfill a prophecy that there would be a Theodoros who would restore the Ethiopian Empire to greatness and rule for 40 years. So I'm that guy, he's saying.
That's really interesting. You know, another thing I'd want to call listeners' attention to, we posted a map of Africa pre-scramble, like 1880. And one thing that I noticed when I only looked at it because I was reading about Ethiopia, but if you look at the Ethiopia Tripolitania control of this chunk of Africa, and you look at where Ethiopia is, you see that the entire coast of Ethiopia is actually controlled by the Ottomans. Mm-hmm. So you have Ethiopia, and then you have the entire strip of coast is actually considered part of Ottoman Egypt. So that's a limiting factor.
And he's no friend of Egypt. Egypt is the enemy, in fact. They are controlling Sudan, and they have invaded Ethiopia a couple of times. But now Theodoros is striking back. He was unfortunately defeated in 1848 at a battle called Dabarki. So that ends his invasion of the Sudan. But it made him realize he needed to modernize his military. He had to incorporate firearm drills. He needed more modern artillery. It's a little bit like the Peter the Great story.
Yeah, or all of them. The Persian emperors, the Ottoman emperors. I mean, everybody, right?
There's this. Yeah, but I mean, strictly in the sense of losing a battle and realizing I got to fix my army. Mm-hmm. And in the same moment, he realized I need to modernize Ethiopia. So here's that connection to all of those stories of modernizers attempting to bring their countries to a position where they can either compete or resist with other countries. So he's trying to unify his country, and that's going to be difficult. Ethiopia does not have the same strong tradition of centralizing monarchs, and he was almost always away on campaign. So he frequently has to deal with disloyal leaders or commanders who are trying to replace him or dislodge him while he's away fighting battles elsewhere. So there's a lot of people who still want, the time of the princes and are thinking, hey, I could do what he did. But they weren't successful. Theodore was very good at crushing rebellions and uprisings. And he brought more Ethiopian territory back under his direct rule. He crushed the princes of Wolo and Tigray and brought regions, Begemder and Simeon. They're called recalcitrant regions. I guess they didn't like being controlled.
I hear about the first one, Begemder, a couple of times in later stories.
So the death of his wife changed things. Now, they call her his beloved wife, but
she's important politically, right?
Oh, gosh, yeah. She's really his claim to the throne, right? Yeah. But her death somehow marked the start of a change in his behavior. He became increasingly erratic, unpredictable, and vengeful. And that vengeful, He let it all out. He didn't hold back. His tendencies have been called brutal. They say that his wife had a calming influence on him. But he, went to extremes. There was an English traveler, John Bell, who'd become a friend of his and confidant. He was murdered. And Theodore took revenge by having 500 prisoners beheaded. I don't know what their
completely
connection...
unrelated to
yeah. I don't know what their connection to the murder was, but boy, he sure took out his anger on them. In 1863, after defeating another rebel, Ted Lagualu, Theodore killed the 7,000 prisoners he had taken.
That's, yeah, I mean, Marcus, it's not Herbert, sorry, it's Harold Marcus. This is the Oxford University book, 1975. So it's a bit old, but we're talking about older times than that, so I suppose. But in any case, Marcus thinks that it's because of like resistance to his rule. So it's a lot of, it's a lot of frustration at not being able to bring the country under control as much as the, you know, the loss of his wife and so on. So he was, you know, and as far as resistance goes, as a would-be modernizer, he's trying to get more money. He's trying to get more taxes, and the source of cash, the only place that has all the cash is the church in Ethiopia. So he's trying to make reforms to the church and reduce the number of priests, but the priests are very organized, and they're able to stop him. And they also, the priests also have a tremendous power that, you know, modernizers don't get until quite a bit later, which is they have the ability to to do propaganda through their churches. You know, in Marcus's words, they poison the minds of the peasantry against the emperor, whom they characterized as an illegitimate upstart. So he's in big trouble by the 1860s.
So shades of the Ottoman Empire and Iran and Persia and...
Yeah.
Yeah, we've heard this story before. Yeah, it's interesting because the Robin Hood stuff is well documented, but then again, so is the savagery in executing people.
Yeah, maybe so, that those things are somehow linked in a way, like you get resentful of it or something. Like, I shouldn't have been so generous before.
Yeah, or by the 14th or 15th rebellion,
yeah,
you figure you have to do something to discourage future rebellions. October of 1862, his position as ruler had become precarious. Much of Ethiopia was in revolt against him, except for a small area, including his fortress at Magdala. Constant military campaigns against, I mean, the list of rebels is too long to cover. He's also still threatened by Turks and Egyptians coming from the Red Sea and from the Sudan. And there's the Oromo tribe, who are Muslim, expanding through central Ethiopia. So looking for help, looking for assistance anywhere he could, Theodore wrote to Queen Victoria. Maybe it's because he had this English friend or a couple of English friends, but he wrote to Queen Victoria, stressing their common Christianity. So as one Christian monarch to another, could you help me out here a little bit? I think he's aware that the English have been fighting Muslims and he's fighting Muslims, so let's make common cause. So there was a British consul, a Captain Cameron, and Theodore asked him to carry a letter to Queen Victoria. He wants skilled workers to come and teach his subjects how to produce firearms and other technical skills. So there's the, you know, Peter the Great similarity again. Cameron traveled to the coast with a letter, and when he reached the Foreign Office contacts and told them what the letter was and what it contained, the Foreign Office said, okay, take it to London. Just mail it. Send it to London. You don't have to take it in person. They sent Cameron to the Sudan, some mission connected with the slave trade. And after he did this, Cameron went back to Ethiopia. And when Cameron returned, Theodore was furious that he had not taken the letter to London personally. He was also furious that Cameron had not brought a response from Queen Victoria. And third, furious that Cameron had spent his time traveling through Egyptian and Turkish territories, so he got suspicious.
Oh, so, that would have been an awkward meeting, eh?
Yeah. So Cameron's saying, hey, don't worry, the reply will arrive shortly. And in one of those little strange happenings in history, the Foreign Office did not pass the letter to Queen Victoria. They just filed it under pending. And the letter sat there for a year. So some historians say that they deliberately ignored the letter because their interests in Northeast Africa were quite different from those of Theodore. Rather than wanting to fight the Muslims, they're planning to, you know, penetrate the Ottoman Empire, Egypt, and the Sudan economically, politically, strategically. They're going to use Egypt, not fight them. So they have no interest in a Christian crusade against Islam. They're worried about, you know, grand power politics, things like the route to India, supplies of cotton. I mean, the American Civil War is on at this time, interrupting trade with the American South for cotton. So that makes Egypt much more important for the supply. So all of these things that there's another great game going on here.
And the Christian bond doesn't quite cut it for Britain and an African monarch, I don't think.
No. So 2 years go by, no answer from Queen Victoria, and Theodore is furious, so he imprisons Cameron and then says, I'm going to go one step better. He arrests and imprisons all the British in Ethiopia. And then for bonus points, other Europeans. So this isn't simply an angry reprisal. He seems to have been wanting to get Queen Victoria's attention. So among the prisoners was an Anglican missionary named Stern. He'd already written a book published in Europe describing Theodore as barbaric, cruel, and an unstable usurper.
These people have chutzpah, eh? I mean, you're just hanging out in this place. You're publishing books about how barbaric they are, and yet, you know, you're just hanging out there, sure that nothing will happen to you based on.
If he is as barbaric, cruel, and unstable as you say, this might not be the best place to camp out. So apparently, Theodore saw the book, became violently angry, and pulled a gun on Stern. And I don't know who
restrained him. And Stern was like, look, proof that he is barbaric.
Well, yeah, Theodore had to be restrained from killing him. But then he took Stern's two servants and had them beaten to death.
That's not fair. What did they do? They didn't write the book.
Yeah, exactly.
It's always the servants. Even in Hollywood movies, it's always the servants that get it.
Yeah. Theodore also received reports from abroad that foreign newspapers had quoted people like Stern and some of the other European residents saying negative things about him and about his reign.
Yeah. Wow. Locally, there was also a famine in 1865. Theodoros had gone on punitive raids in 1866, including sacking and burning Gondar. He'd had 800 soldiers killed on suspicion that they might desert in 1867. Of course, one effect of preemptively executing soldiers on suspicion of desertion is actual desertion, which starts to happen, and lots of these people start to desert to rival armies at this point.
So the stress is getting to him? Is that what you think?
I think so.
The funny thing is that for all of the Stern's and negative comments, there are some others, maybe a little earlier chronologically speaking, but there are some other European descriptions of Theodore that are interesting. This is from an Englishman named Plowden. The king is young in years, vigorous in all manly exercises, of a striking countenance, peculiarly polite and engaging when pleased, and mostly displaying great tact and delicacy. He's persuaded that he is destined to restore the glories of the Ethiopian Empire and to achieve great conquests. Untiring energy, both mental and bodily, his personal and moral daring is boundless. When aroused, his wrath is terrible and all tremble.
Well, there it is.
But at all moments, he possesses a perfect self-control. Indefatigable. He takes little repose, night or day. His ideas and language are clear and precise. Hesitation is not known to him, and he has no counselors or go-between. That's an interesting little revelation. Fond of splendor, unsparing in punishment, necessary in a wilderness as Abyssinia at that time. He salutes his meanest or poorest subjects with courtesy, is sincerely, though often mistakenly, religious, and will acknowledge a fault committed to his poorest follower. Generous to excess, free from all cupidity, he's not greedy, regarding nothing with pleasure or desire but munitions of war for his soldiers. He has exercised the utmost clemency towards the vanquished. I guess this is much earlier. His faith is signal. Without Christ, I am nothing. There's a lot of contradictory messages in that quotation.
I mean, yeah, it's quite a characterization, right? It's like, and you know, when you write fiction, they do tell you this. Like, if you're writing somebody who is calm, then you also have to kind of reveal some kind of anger. Like every characterization includes both poles of both opposites.
Well, he's got them. German botanist Georg Schimper. Theodore, the new king of kings of Ethiopia, was certainly the most remarkable man that has appeared in Africa for some centuries. At the date of his assumption of the regal title, Theodore was 37 years of age, of medium stature, but possessing a well-knit muscular frame, capable of ensuring any amount of fatigue, a noble bearing, majestic walk, and he was the best shot, the best spearman, the best runner, and the best horseman in Abyssinia. Don't know how that fits with the other descriptions.
They do that all the time. Remember they did that with Bolivar too? Well, I guess Bolivar did it himself.
Yeah. The queen finally sent a letter. British queen, that is. She sent an Assyrian-born British subject, Hormuzd Rassam, and she sent him a letter 3 years after he requested aid. No skilled workers, and Theodore was deeply insulted. The British did not do as he had asked or told, so he took the Rassam mission, Rassam and his entourage, and added them to his other European prisoners. This is a breach of diplomatic immunity. You're not supposed to arrest or imprison diplomats. I know we've seen plenty of episodes of it, but Britain's not going to take this lying down. So this is the spur to a British expedition of 1868. So they gather some troops, a force of about 13,000, under a commander, Robert Napier. Napier had seen action in the First and Second Sikh Wars. After the Indian Mutiny, he was at Lucknow in 1858, served in the Second Opium War, and was at Beijing in 1860.
Oh, so he's one of these guys.
Yeah, that's been everywhere. Yeah, yeah. And he had an unusual nickname, Bug Hunter Bob. Don't even ask where that came from. So Napier has 13,000 soldiers and about 26,000 camp followers.
And most of these are Indian, I assume.
Yes.
Probably.
Yeah, I think so. He has not only soldiers, but engineers and other specialists. The British are already aware that the terrain will be difficult and challenging.
Oh yeah, we should talk a little bit about you. You know, if you're listening and you want to look at Ethiopia on Google Maps, you know, take a look at the satellite view. It's pretty mountainous. You know, when we talk about the fortresses of these leaders, the fortresses are pretty formidable. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you're looking at the satellite view, you'll see considerable.
And when you see that the regions are slightly different ethnicities, then you start to think, wow, this looks like Afghanistan.
Yeah. That's ways. Right. Because there's some kind of like regional, regional differences. Like people mm-hmm. from the same region are of a different ethnicity.
Yeah, and that's what ended up costing Theodore.
Right. So the whole, like Marcus again, he says, you know, by this time, given all the things that Theodoros had done, he says Ethiopia was unwilling to fight for a monarch whose domestic policies were bankrupt and whose international policies were illusory. Like, he hadn't gotten anything for all of his attempts to try to contact the British, right?
Yeah.
Marcus says that the British brought a large army of English and Indians with vast supplies. They brought £9 million worth of supplies. So,
there's two servants, porters, support people for every soldier. So... I don't know if it counts as a large army when it's only 13,000 soldiers, but when you're moving 40,000 people, okay, that would look pretty big. And they were certainly well supplied. There was a battle at Eroge on the 10th of April, and Theodore was decisively defeated. He only had 4,000 men left, but typically refused to surrender and retreated to his fortress at Magdala. The British besieged it and shelled it, apparently killing quite a few. And here, Theodore, I don't even know what to think of this. He released the European prisoners unharmed, but followed that up by throwing 300 Ethiopian prisoners off a cliff. So the British ended up storming Magdala, and apparently Theodore committed suicide. There's a story that he supposedly used one of the pistols Queen Victoria had sent him. Theodore was buried. Napier allowed his troops to loot Magdala as a punitive measure.
Well, he was, I mean, look, we did talk about his resume. He is a looter par excellence.
Yeah. According to a historian named Pankhurst, 15 elephants and 200 mules were required to carry away the booty. Wow. And they ended up spread around Europe in museums and state collections. As of now, I think a few of the looted artifacts have been returned to Ethiopia.
Maybe another moment to mention the new book this year by Dan Hicks, The Brutish Museums.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Dan Hicks wrote a book. It's 2020, actually. It focuses on the Benin bronzes. I don't know much about the Benin bronzes. They were looted in 1897, Nigeria. Mm. The loot was passed on to Queen Victoria and the British Museum, countless private collections. So he focuses on this, but it's a case study where he basically says everything needs to be returned. Give it all back. And Marcus's assessment here about why the British didn't, start the scramble, get a jump on the scramble. Oh, do you want to jump in first?
The moral of this story to me is fascinating. After Theodore is dead, the British helped Emperor Menelik II be crowned emperor, and then they left.
Yeah,
which I find astonishing. We mentioned the vast supplies for this army, and Justin mentioned they they spent £9 million on supplies. That's a pretty big investment in what is a hostage situation, or going to rescue the prisoners. So they dethrone Theodore, let his replacement take over, and leave. They did not establish a protectorate. They did not, as far as I know, sign a treaty with the new emperor that obliged him to, you know, any action. There's no economic deal. They packed up their mules, took their loot, and they left.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, you know, the Army of Revenge in Afghanistan in 1842, they've done this before, these punitive expeditions. So it's, and there are some similarities with Afghanistan, eh? I mean,
yes.
Terrain and landlocked. It's curiously landlocked, despite in Ethiopia's case being very close to the coast.
I just find the date really interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
It's 1868.
It's like the last time anybody left Africa alone, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're that's for sure.
So Marcus says military authorities realized that Ethiopia remained unconquered. Only one man and a few of his followers had been defeated. To subdue and occupy Ethiopia would have required a massive army. Napier therefore burned Theodoros in the church at Magdala and on 14th of April, razed the bastion and evacuated the area on 17th, 18th April, thus completing one of the most expensive affairs of honor in history. So
that's an interesting thing to call it, an affair of honor.
Yeah.
And I agree with Marcus that the men on the spot, Napier would probably have realized very early on, yeah, I don't think we're here to conquer Ethiopia. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But then again, that leaves out your favorite, the cabal back in London. What instructions did they give Napier? And how did they know that Ethiopia would have been difficult to conquer?
Well, you know, it's like the imperial mystique, right? Like they did it just to restore that mystique, to make sure, you know, you don't do this to our imperial agents. Like,
right.
You'll pay for it.
Yeah, but this is not capitalism running rampant.
Well, you know, capitalism runs rampant in a complicated way, for sure. Like our theory is flexible, but like, you know, like I just think about like the Americans. They just bombed some village in Nangarhar as punishment for the bombing at the airport in Kabul, which was,
yes.
You know, and it just goes on. So they're like, yeah, okay, we could bomb you, you know? We're leaving, and we're leaving our bases, but we can still bomb you. So so there.
Okay, so whereas I persist in seeing the 1868 invasion of Abyssinia as something unusual that does not fit with the scramble at all.
Well, it's before, though. It's early.
Not much before. Things changed, I agree with you, but they changed very quickly afterwards.
Yeah. I'm just looking at this map again. That part of Africa, right? Like the whole navigation through there and the importance of that. When's the canal completed?
69.
Yeah.
Like a year later.
So that, you know, that they, probably they would have calculated a little differently even had that been completed at that time. But let's go on. So Menelik II, we mentioned. Menelik II, his father was Haile Malakot, one of these nobles who had actually fought Theodoros and whose father had been killed by Theodoros in battle. And Menelik said, you know, although he killed my father and took me to his court, he always loved me as a son. So he grew up as one of the, you know, like a, what do you call these people? There's ladies in waiting, if they're ladies, but if you're, I guess, a courtier. He was a courtier, right? Mm-hmm. But he did start to raise an army against Theodoros in the 1860s. When the British invaded, Menelik prevaricated. He didn't want to side openly with the British. Other people did. Other Ethiopian nobles did, but not him. He was politically concerned that siding with a foreign invader would lose him political points. And also personal reasons, he had some kind of soft spot for Theodoros, despite fighting him militarily. So Napier actually had a different candidate in mind, a different Casa. I know Theodoros' original name was Casa too. But they had a person that they from Tigray, a nobleman from Tigray, Casa, who had worked with them, collaborated with them when they invaded. So Napier, you know, this talk about this 9 million pounds of stuff, he gave Casa half a million worth of stuff, 6 mortars, 6 howitzers, 900 muskets and rifles. What's a percussion cap, Dave?
Well, bullets.
Okay, 585,000 percussion caps and a large amount of commissariat stock ranging from biscuits to beer, according to Marcus. So this is like a, you know, year of the many emperors. There's one nobleman named Wagsham Gobadze who declares himself emperor. Menelik does the same. And Casa is a little bit more patient. So he realizes, he says, I rule only in Tigray, which is 1/3 of the Abyssinian kingdom. And he was mainly worried about this Gobadze, who called himself Emperor Tekla Georgis. So he hires a man named Kirkham, who had been adjutant general to Gordon in China. We'll be hearing a lot more about Gordon in this series. And he was defeated, though, Gobadze, this Tekla Georgis, was defeated in battle at Adwa, taken prisoner in 1871. He was blinded and imprisoned and executed later. And Casa, his rival, was crowned Emperor Johannes. So, and getting yourself crowned emperor properly is actually, you need some kind of official called an Anan, who comes from Egypt, so that he had to get that person sent to him from Egypt to be duly crowned. So Johannes is emperor, and in 1872, we have Egypt invade. And now we're going to talk a lot about that too, right, Dave? We're going to talk about Egypt's Egypt as a kind of ambitious imperial power during the scramble for Africa, which is pretty much shut down ultimately by the British. But we'll but this campaign is also a big part of why the Egyptians fail in their imperial ambitions. So they get a Swiss German commander named Werner Munzinger.
Munzinger Pasha.
So Munzinger Pasha invades. Johannes protests to the British, but they're not really going to do anything for him. It's 1872. The canal is going. Egypt invades. And Menelik tries. Menelik, his, you know, a rival of Johannes, he negotiates with the Khedive in Cairo. So the Khedive, the would-be, you know, imperialist here in Egypt, he wants to use Menelik to crush Johannes and then turn on Menelik. Menelik is aware of this, so it's a kind of a three-way problem here. In 1875, Munzinger is killed in battle by one of Johannes's allies, the Afar of Ausa. Another Egyptian force advances, and Johannes calls he makes a big mobilization. So 70,000 troops assemble at Adwa against 2,500 Egyptians. The Egyptians have obviously better weapons. They're trained and organized, but Johannes annihilates their army. And he kind of makes it a Christian thing. He says, we've baptized with blood those who have never been baptized with water. So he definitely takes it there. And in the process, though, to Menelik's chagrin, Johannes gets his hands on 2,500 rifles, 14 artillery pieces, and 20,000 thalers in cash. I don't know how much a thaler is, but I think it's a big unit of money. So Egypt invades again in 1876 with 20,000 troops, and Johannes assembles 200,000 troops and defeats them again. And gets his hands now on 12,000 more Remington rifles, 16 cannon, and more. So Menelik is pretty devastated by
not going well
by Johannes. He didn't pick the right side here. So he tries to make deals with others. So he sends a priest, Abba Mikhail, to France and Italy to try to get an arms supply going, but. And he's also, like Theodoros, he says, send me a doctor, engineer, and a mechanic, and get good men specializing in woodwork and ironwork. I will respect them and treat them well and reward them properly. He also offers missionaries a free hand. He gets a businessman, Pierre Arnault, a French businessman in Egypt. Was this guy involved in the canal?
I don't know.
So he suggests to him maybe a French colony to rejuvenate Ethiopia and the old slave trade. We've got to stop the slave trade, even though Ethiopia is not really doing the slave trade. But Menelik invites him. He makes a pitch. Pierre Arnault makes a pitch in Menelik's kingdom of Shua in 1876. Arnault brings rifles, revolvers. And two new Italians come, Antinori and Martini, and they show off their weapons. So Menelik gives Martini a job as his agent in Italy, who goes to Italy in 1877, but doesn't end up doing very much for him.
International so he's arms got dealers. I didn't realize it went back that far.
Yeah. In Africa too. Yeah, it's true. Menelik in 1877. So he's a man with problems. You know, he's got inferior weapons and he's got trouble in his kingdom, political trouble, because his consort Bafana is ambitious and insults his heir Meshesha. He takes her side, imprisons him because she's accusing him that he's a traitor. There are other players fighting, but in 1878, Johannes comes to Shewa and demands that Menelik beg his pardon, present himself naked to the waist with a stone on his neck. So Menelik says no, but he doesn't fight. He retreats. And Johannes is running out of supplies for his men, so he ends up making a truce. And finally, Menelik submits to Johannes' authority. Johannes basically says, I was never emperor until you submitted to my authority. He makes a big deal of forgiving Menelik. And, you know, he says, you're my eldest son. And they get along well for the next little while. In 1879, Johannes doesn't want to do business with Europeans, and Menelik actually overrules him successfully. He trades with France through Shewa. Pierre Arnault forms the Franco-Ethiopian Company and arrives in Obak in 1881. He establishes a colony with 25 Europeans in October 1881, but he alienates the local people and they kill him. There's an interesting note here, Dave. It's one of these historical notes where, you know, you really wonder what happened, because Marcos, the historian, seems to know, but doesn't say. Marcus says, his problems with the local politicians and people led him to an unfortunate show of power. And so they killed him.
Yeah, you can imagine a whole bunch of things that he could be doing to annoy everybody. It could even be something awful.
Yeah.
But you can also see him taking the position like, don't you know who I am? And then, you know, taking some high-handed position, I don't know, kidnapping or arresting someone with no authority whatsoever, right. And they showed him.
I'm kind of a big deal around here.
Yeah.
So Menelik's trying to do a treaty with Italy. He gets a draft of it when Martini comes back. Martini comes back with an important Italian named Count Pietro Antonelli, who was well-connected at court. they sign a rifles contract in 1881. The rifles are actually delivered in 1883. And so he's so happy with his rifles that he signs a treaty in 1883 as an equal sovereign power with Italy. That's what he's interested in. And that's what he's up to. Johannes is also interested in such a treaty. But then Italy, as you'll see, occupies a piece of Abyssinia. And so that kind of takes the wind out of the sails of the alliance. Marcus concludes here that the probability of Egyptian imperialism had been diminished, not just by these defenses in the 1870s, but also by the British action against the Ahmed Urabi Pasha rebellion, of which we will hear much more. Indeed. So Menelik is running low on cash. He does a number of raids into Arusi. He steals 100,000 cattle. He's got a modern army. He abandons Bafana and marries Taitu, who's a very patriotic Ethiopian noblewoman. So this is a good alliance for him. So he's overcome a number of his short-term problems by 1883. So Egypt sends an agent to Shewa to ask them to close the sea route, I guess it's a land route, the Obak-Shewa route. He refuses because he's working with the Italians and the French. The Khedive actually of Egypt sent General Charles Gordon to Ethiopia in 1879 to try to get an agreement with Johannes. But according to Harold Marcus, he says, conditioned by the racialist attitudes of British imperialism, Gordon came with no serious proposals, apparently hoping to buy the emperor off with words, money, and gifts, which apparently has worked for them elsewhere, but not with Johannes. Gordon, in turn, called Johannes a sour, ill-favored-looking being. He never looks you in the face. He never smiles. His look is one of thorough suspicion. Hated and hating all, I can imagine no more unhappy man. So they did not get along. Sporadic warfare continues between Ethiopia and Egypt until the Mahdi rebellion and the Sudan situation, which we will get back to in a different episode. And the overall, battle, the overall fight is because Johannes wants Ethiopia to have a port. And as we mentioned below, Egypt controls the entire coast, so they did not want him to have one. And Egypt ultimately even tells Lord Cromer, another character we'll hear an awful lot about, that they'd be willing to give that port up, but they can't. Hands are tied because because it's an Ottoman issue. They'd have to clear it with the Sultan.
That was interesting about Gordon. I'm not sure about that racialist attitude. Because we saw Gordon in China, and he didn't seem to be racialist there. he served the Chinese emperor pretty loyally and, adopted Chinese clothing. And
he's not even consistently racialist.
Well, no, I'm just thinking the Gordon that I know of at this period is acting erratically himself.
Oh, I see.
He's on this mission from God kick.
Oh, yeah, right.
So if you don't do what I tell you to, you're interfering with my holy mission.
Right.
I wonder if that isn't part of it. It's a minor detail. But there are major details going on here because, once again, there's a great game going on in Eastern Africa. A little bit like the great game in India and Afghanistan, where the players are not all local. So part of this has to do with Egypt. So just a reminder, Egypt had been very much in the French sphere of influence. If we go back to Muhammad Ali, and the French failure to support him in his war against the Ottoman Sultan. But this is changing very quickly after the canal. The British are much more economically involved. And the two countries, France and Britain, are basically both managing the Egyptian ruler. They're both telling him what to do, and yet they're still competing with each other.
I was going to say, are they telling him the same thing, or are they telling him?
Well, I think financially they are, but the partnership is, I mean, England and France in a partnership, it just doesn't sound right. They've been rivals for so long, and even the Crimean War, you know, fighting on the same side, didn't change that. So they're also trying to undermine each other, and especially the French. So the English are in a dominant position in Egypt, and one of the major goals of French foreign policy is to diminish that British influence, to get Egypt back in the French sphere. And then the Suez Canal, it leads you, obviously, directly towards the Horn of Africa. So the French are interested in this area. So they grab a little piece of territory, French Somaliland, and it lets them set up a naval base at Djibouti on the Red Sea. So the region is now strategic for the British and the French, which makes it strategic for all of Europe, because in this period, you have the alliances, the Triple Alliance, and eventually the Ententes, but they're still shifting. So the French have a naval base on the Red Sea that could, if there's a war against Britain, could intercept or interfere with British shipping and the shortcut to India. So Britain is not that keen to have the French in Somaliland. And the French trying to kind of push the English out of Egypt, there's this game going on between France and Britain, and for them, Ethiopia is a possible piece in the game. Don't know yet whether it's a pawn or a bishop or a rook, but you know, could be very important. For the French, according to Marcus again, Ethiopia is the source of the Nile, the entrance to the Nile Valley. If the French take over Ethiopia, they could, you know, kind of control the Nile, and they could also link it to their West African colonies. Here's this dream of a French African empire stretching from West Africa to East Africa. So the British, in return, are interested in keeping the French out. And how do we do that? Well, the Egyptians are not strong enough to control the coast anymore. And if the Ethiopians control it directly, they might, you know, they've been talking to the French, and we know that. We don't want a French or Ethiopian control of the coast, the Horn of Africa. And that's why Britain decided to encourage the Italians. So the Italians.
Yeah, so it's their whole, like, the British are always the sponsors of the weak imperialists. Because they don't want to, yeah, because that's their whole balance. Everything they do is for balance, right? They don't want to support someone who's closer to them in strength, because they'll be empowering right. A rival. Yeah.
Right. And the British know that the Italians and the French are not getting along. They've got their rivalry in North Africa, which I'll come to in a moment.
Yeah, that's going to come up again. Yeah.
And again and again. So in 1884, there was a treaty, the Hewitt Treaty, between Britain, Egypt, and Ethiopia. So Ethiopia will be allowed to occupy parts of Eritrea and will allow their goods to pass duty-free in and out of Massawa.
Because Eritrea is an Italian colony from going back to like 1869, 70, it becomes official in 1881 or something. So it's right. It's an Italian colony at this point. So
yeah, the Egyptians can't maintain their power on the Horn of Africa anymore. So somebody's got to replace them. Will it be Ethiopia or will it be the Italians or possibly both? So the English, in a fine bit of double dealing, are talking very nice to Emperor Johannes and saying, yeah, we'll let you in here. But they are planning to eventually handed over to Italy. British historian Augustus Wilde. England made use of King John, that's Emperor Johannes, as long as he was of any service, and then threw him over to the tender mercies of Italy. It is one of our worst bits of business out of the many we have been guilty of in Africa, one of the vilest bites of treachery.
We're just saying a lot.
I mean, there's a pretty long list of competitors for that title. So this is the English are trying to profit from Italian rivalry with France. The Italians are upset because in 1881, the French suddenly and unexpectedly turned Tunisia into a protectorate. And the Italians, if you look at a map, Tunisia's very close to Sicily. So the Italians are outraged. They call this the Schiaffo di Tunisi, the slap of Tunis. And this was enough for Bismarck to jump in and say, hey, Italy, you hate France too? And Italy joins the Triple Alliance with Germany and Austria-Hungary. The British are flirting with the Triple Alliance and using Italy to counter France. That's the international politics of the whole deal.
There are two notes to make. One is like, it's amazing when you think that Italy has only just been unified like 10, 20 years before this.
Right.
And Germany too. Like that's one thing that's kind of shocking. The other thing is like they think they're getting slapped because of something happening in Tunisia. You know,
yeah, you grabbed Tunisia. I wanted it.
Yeah.
That's the whole story right there. You're right. There's something about Italian unification that is directly connected to this. So basically in 1885, the Italians seize Massawa, which was promised as, you know, duty-free for Ethiopia. So that deal is defunct. The Italian reasons for this imperialist policy are remarkably like Argentina seizing the Falkland Islands. It's a distraction. The post-unification government in Italy has been very unsuccessful. 1861.
They're not delivering. Yeah.
No, they are not delivering on the glorious new era that was promised in Italian life. Many, many Italians are bitterly disappointed to find that nothing has changed in the Kingdom of Italy. Most Italians still live in poverty. And in some cases, abject poverty.
And I guess huge numbers of Italians are going to America in this period.
Yes, that's part of it. That's for sure. That's part of it. Southern Italy is not being developed. There are parts of Southern Italy that will be without. I mean, it's too early to talk about electricity, but I saw myself towns in Southern Italy that didn't get electricity until the 1970s or 80s.
Wow.
So underdevelopment, poverty, corruption at the top. So in an attempt to distract the population, the government embarks on this imperialist policy. The newspapers are helping. Il Diritto editorial. Italy must be ready. 1885 will decide her fate as a great power.
Right.
It is necessary to feel the responsibility of the new era, to become again strong men afraid of nothing, with the sacred love of the fatherland of all Italy in our hearts. And of course, this is all, you know, nationalist BS. But the whole purpose here is to get people fired up about an empire so that they forget about how crappy things are back at home.
Yeah. And then in terms of like, just to get back to the strategy, you know, this whole geopolitical geekery, I guess. If you look at a map of post-scramble Africa, you see again, like Ethiopia has retained independence, and we'll tell you why in a minute and how. But Italian colonies of Eritrea and Somaliland are control those potential outlets to the sea.
Yep.
And then there's the little French thing right on the on that peninsula, like on that choke point.
Yeah, that's Djibouti. Straits,
yeah, Djibouti, and then there's a British, territory there too, Somaliland again. So
it was known as the Afars and Issas.
Okay, good. Yeah, well, I mean, we'll get to that because I've been reading about the Dervish movement. Which is pretty awesome. So I'll dedicate an episode to them later. But I guess what all I'm saying is, you know, control of that coastline is key, and they are definitely willing to fight Africans for it and each other for it as Europeans. So when the Italians take Massawa, Menelik says this is a prelude to a certain war between Italy and Abyssinia. He doesn't want to. He offers to mediate because he's friendly with the Italians. And Johannes does negotiate, the Emperor Johannes, because he's trying at the same time to put down a rebellion in Wolo, which is inspired by the Mahdi, and the local governor there is pretty anti-Muslim. So they're rebelling. Menelik and Johannes get together to pacify Wolo with their armies. And Italy sends an ambassador to Massawa, Giorgio Pozzolini. So Johannes writes to Menelik and he says, if we two remain united always, the Italians will not tire us, and with the help of God, we will be victorious. So they start fighting. There are battles with the Italians here. They have a battle at Dogali. It's not a very big battle, but they defeat the Italians. The Italians call it the Dogali Massacre.
I found it significant. Okay. You're right. It's more of a skirmish than a battle.
Yeah.
Obviously, the Ethiopians have the numbers.
Yeah.
And about 500 Italian soldiers under a Colonel De Cristoforis, they get ambushed by Ethiopians under Ras Alula. And his men are mostly armed with spears, but they were very successful at surrounding the Italians, who retreated from one hill to another higher hill and then ran out of ammunition. And that's when Ras Alula ordered his men to charge, and the Italians were overwhelmed. Bayonets against spears, and the Ethiopians won. The Italians lost 23 officers and 407 troopers killed. And that leads to the Italians retreating back to the Red Sea coast. And Italian newspapers, they're the ones who called it a massacre. But they're more angry at their own government for not giving De Cristoforis enough ammunition. And after this defeat, that scares the British. You know, we've backed Italy. If they don't control this area, we're going to end up with an anti-Italian, possibly anti-British Ethiopia. So the British step in and offer to mediate.
Well, Leopoldo Traversi, who I guess is back in on the home front, on the mothership in Italy, he tells Antonelli, the Italian agent in Abyssinia, he says, Abyssinia will not be defeated with 20,000 or 30,000 men. Mm. So they know it's going to be a big deal if they want to take it. And Menelik, while Johannes is fighting the Italians, Menelik takes additional territory for himself, the territory of Harar. He absorbs it into his empire and makes it the center of his arms trade, which overshadows all other commerce in his kingdom by 1887. He signs a secret treaty with the Italians in 1887.
Oh,
yeah, there's sneaky. A secret Italian treaty in 1887.
Yeah, and I've read from the Italian perspective, they thought that what happened to Theodore, that they could repeat it.
Yeah.
They thought that they could find plenty of Ethiopian princes who'd be willing to turn on Johannes and support them.
Yeah.
And Menelik obviously is giving them hope that that's going to happen.
In 1888, Johannes takes a big army of 80,000 men to challenge the Italian general Di San Marzano in Sahati. Marzano takes the better part of valor and stays in his fort. So Johannes' soldiers eventually get sick and he has to retreat. He reorganizes the Mahdi's army. Again, we'll hear more about them, but the Mahdists, he's dead, I can't think at this point. The Mahdists invade Gojam and Begemder. They defeat Johannes's army. They sack and burn Gondar. Menelik is ordered to Begemder to help relieve these forces. And in the face of Menelik's army, the Mahdists actually retreat. Menelik's troops actually get sick too. He's continually trying to find a way to de-escalate the problem between Italy and Johannes, but eventually he declares war on Johannes.
Ouch.
Yeah. So Johannes, meanwhile, has to go fight the Mahdists again. He takes another huge army, 100,000 men at Metemma. He's beating them handily on day one. He breaches the enemy line, but then he gets shot and dies. So the Mahdists follow the retreating army. They capture the body of the emperor. They decapitate it, put it on a camel caravan all over North Sudan. It's a bad scene. So 1889, Ethiopia is now in bad shape. Villages are ruined. There's rinderpest, animal typhus, dysentery. Apparently millions of people died in this plague year. Hundreds of thousands more are leaving their land. One third of the population of one place, Let Marafia, which is some place we know about, died. So we can get a sense of if that scales up. Menelik takes over the throne in 1889. And now he's inherits the Italians. The Italian general Baldissera wants to wait for local divisions before he attacks. And he's also trying to suppress, hunger riots and stuff in Massawa. So he's not keen to fight or create a bigger problem with Menelik. Menelik also owes 2 million in lira to Italy in debt. So, you know, the financial element of this, we can talk more about in the Egypt episode, but let's just say that the financial aspect is significant.
So both sides have their problems.
Yeah.
Which is why they signed another treaty in 1889. This one's really, really quite significant. It's the Treaty of Vucale. Basically, Ethiopia, Menelik, recognizes Italian control over Eritrea. In return, the Italians recognize Menelik as emperor. And it's interesting because the treaty is bilingual. It's in Italian.
Oh, is it ever?
And in Amharic.
So here's the problem. The Italian and the Amharic treaties don't match. And the Amharic version says that he can use the Italians to treat as his emissaries to other European powers. The Italian version says he has to use them as his external representative. So in the Italian version, he's basically their subordinate, and in the Amharic version, they're his agents in Europe. And there's the, I guess this is the, it becomes famous as Clause 17. And, one clerk apparently tells Menelik, I don't think they understood this is just the Amharic version of the clause. He says, the clauses of the agreement with the exception of the 17th are good. That one may not weigh one quarter of a dollar now, but in a year's time, it can be heavier than 1,000 tons of lead. So there were some issues even with the Amharic version. The clerk apparently, when Menelik went to Antonelli and said, what's up with this clause? Antonelli said, no, there's nothing wrong with the clause. So Menelik punished the clerk for bringing that to his attention. So Menelik is properly coronated. His coronation is November 3rd, 1889. So he, as a newly coronated emperor, he contacts Queen Victoria directly, of course, and Queen Victoria says, sorry, old chap, I'm afraid that our Italian friends have let us know that I'm not allowed to talk to you directly and that everything goes through them, so I'll be talking to them to you from now on. And so he is not, that's not, he's not happy about that.
Understandably. He also wrote to Kaiser Wilhelm II.
Are they related, Victoria and Wilhelm? No.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
They're yeah, they are. Wilhelm is married to her granddaughter?
Okay.
Yeah, there's a, yeah, they're definitely related. So Menelik writes to Wilhelm II, who sends him back a rude reply, like, don't bother me and don't talk to me anymore. So, yeah. Oh, Antonelli, what a piece of work. He's fluent in Amharic, so he knows very well what he's doing. There's no way that he doesn't know the two versions don't match, regardless of his denials. So when he was exposed, and Menelik was pretty indignant, saying, like, there's no way I would sign away my country's independence to anybody.
Yeah.
But Antonelli left Ethiopia in 1890, and back home he said, oh, Menelik's a black man. He's obviously intrinsically dishonest. It's only natural that he would lie about the protectorate that he, you know, willingly signed.
Right.
Oh, lovely.
So the Italians, they figure it's on. So they occupy Karen and Asmara. They cite the Congress of Berlin, the Article 34 of Congress Berlin, which lets them declare a protectorate. The French deny the Italian claim. The new Italian general, Orero, he advances, he occupies Adwa in Tigray. He says they're doing it on the emperor's behalf. Italy, remember, has the colony in Eritrea is purchased privately in 1869, nationalized in 1882, and it becomes official in 1890. Apparently, just before World War II, the colony had 100,000 Italians there. So,
wow,
you know, it could be a pretty big colony. So Italy is divided apparently into gradualists who want to use Menelik as their vehicle to control the region, and expansionists who want to use Eritrea as a base to directly militarily control the region. So Colonel Luciano, he said, you know, Eritrea should be like a little Sparta in Africa. We should, you know, have soldier peasants, you know, ruling over the natives, lording it over the natives, and no mixing. We should not renounce the supremacy of the white race over these peoples, Luciano says. And Francesco Crispi was the foreign minister of Italy, and he was kind of like the face of Italian imperialism this time.
Ultra imperialism. This is a guy that believed that that Italy required the grandeur of a second Roman Empire, and he thought that the Horn of Africa was the best place for them to start. There's an American journalist named James Perry who wrote that Crispi was a fool, a bigot, and a very dangerous man.
Nice. So Menelik called his resident. When he gets his reply from Queen Victoria, he calls in the resident Salim Beni, and he asks him to explain. Queen Taitu tells him, King Johannes never wanted to cede an inch of territory. He died for this, and you, after such an example, what wish to sell your country? Who will want to tell your history? So his alliance with Italy is in bad shape. He writes to King Umberto of Italy, and he says, listen, I think there's been like a mistranslation. I'm hoping that you guys can just, you know, make a little fix on the text there and just tell the European powers that, you know, that we're good. There's also a land dispute because Italy's claiming Ethiopian territory. Salim Beni comes to the conclusion that war is the only possible solution. They're very upset because Menelik wrote to Victoria. He said, you know, let's handle our treaty business confidentially. So they're upset that he violated confidentiality. Menelik also, on this $2 million debt, Menelik, when he looks at the terms of the debt, the agreement was that interest would be calculated starting in 1892, and they started calculating from 1891. So they're already trying to cheat him on the debt too, and so he's upset about that. trust is at an all-time low. Salubeni tells Menelik, look, it would be capricious not to follow the treaty, and it would hurt our relationship. So how about you just follow it for 5 years? But Menelik does not change his mind. Antonelli tries to change the treaty so that it says, you know, how about we're not a protectorate and no one else is either? But it's still, you know, a little bit humiliating for Menelik. Queen Taitu says, I am a woman and do not love war, but rather than accepting this, I prefer war. So Salimbeni and Antonelli leave Addis Ababa in February 1891. They order the other Italian representatives to leave for Massawa. So it's going to be war. Menelik offers France deals for various infrastructure things, telegraph, passage rights. The British, though, they sign the Anglo-Italian Protocol of March 24th, 1891, recognizing Italy's rights to Ethiopia.
Green light.
Green light. Menelik, he's on the march, though. Like, he's taking new territory as far south as Melmel by 1894. He's fighting with the Somalis. The famine is over by 1894. So he's collecting more tax revenue. The Italians are working with a Tigray chief, Mengesha, to try to get something going against Menelik. They're also trying to get into Mahdist territories to buffer to create a buffer zone. You know the old buffer zones. France wants to get together with Menelik to try to counterbalance British influence in Egypt. But in 1894, in June, Menelik basically patches up the relationships with Mengesha and another potential problem ruler, or I guess nobleman, Ras Wale. So at this point, Ethiopia is united and Italy has no way to make inroads with Ethiopian noblemen.
That proved to be really significant. The Italians had been counting on, especially Tigray, to fight against Menelik, but apparently the Ethiopians can read and they can hear. So they knew all the things the Italians had said, like how they held Africans in contempt.
Yeah.
And the segregation policies in Eritrea, which would no doubt be applied to them.
Exactly. Exactly. So he also tries to cool the Egyptians out. He tells Egypt he doesn't have ambitions on Egyptian territory. He wants the old Christian territories. He wants to build a railway and modernize. There's a businessman, Alfred Ilg. He gives him a 99-year concession to build a railway from Djibouti to Harar, and then Harar to Addis and to Kaffa and the White Nile. Ilg's friend, Chevno, goes to raise money in France, comes back with more guns in October 1894. At that year, Eritreans are actually up in arms against Italian colonizers who are taking their land. The Eritrean rebel leader is Dajach Batha Hagos of Akele Guzai. He used to work for the Italians. And he said, one recovers from the bite of a black snake, but never from the bite of a white snake. So Batha Hagos, he detains Italians. He cuts the telegraph line December 14th, 1894. But the Italians suppress the uprising in 2 days. They kill Batha Hagos. They attack Mengesha's army. They take Tigray, most of Tigray, in January 1895. And this was an easy operation. They had 96% of their troops were native Eritreans, 69 Italian officers, and the cost of the operation was low. So they're thinking, hey, maybe we can beat Menelik after all. The Italian consul general is talking to Lord Cromer over in Cairo and warning him against, that France is trying to get their hands on Ethiopia. So Cromer wants to support Italy. He's concerned about Somalia. He says, a defeat of the Italians by the dervishes, which does not seem impossible, would probably lead to a great deal of trouble here in Egypt. So British stops Germany and Britain from sending any arms, but and including a shipment of 4,000 rifles, he said, the British said, their letter said, we can't give these rifles because we have reason to believe they're intended for use against a friendly power. So Menelik is trying to break his diplomatic isolation. He tries to get into the postal union, but Ilg tells him, you know, Zurich is the Italian campaign against him is too strong. Ilg writes to the French and he says, listen, Menelik can beat Italy. He would be a better friend to us than supporting Italy. But he loses the argument because there's a understanding. There's an Italo-French understanding, basically, where the French are going to recognize Italy and Ethiopia, and Italy is going to recognize France, a protectorate in Tunisia. So that's the big French sellout. So Menelik is on his own. September 17th, 1895, he says, enemies have now come upon us to ruin the country and change our religion. Our enemies have begun the affair by advancing and digging into the country like moles. With the help of God, I will not deliver my country to them. Today, you who are strong, give me of your strength, and you who are weak, help me by prayer. Some of his noblemen are saying, you know, maybe we should make peace. He says, I do not want to hear words of peace. He gathers 100,000 soldiers. And one writer writes about this, Berkeley. He writes, never probably in the history of the world has there been so curious an instance of a commander successfully concealing the numbers of his army and masking his advance behind a complete network of insinuation, false information, and circumstantial deceptions. Every Tukul and village in every far-off glen of Ethiopia was sending out its warrior in answer to the war drum. So that's interesting. Note for the military minded that he conducted this very, very sneakily. The campaign is long. So there, you know, he's mobilizing in September 1895. There's sieges, there's battles, but it all culminates in the Battle of Adwa. Again, Adwa is where so many of these battles have taken place. But this is the big one. March 1st, 1896, where Menelik basically annihilates the Italian army.
Italian General Barrettieri did not want to fight. He knew he was heavily outnumbered. He also was counting on the probability that Menelik couldn't keep that many troops in the field much longer. That he could.
Yeah, that's what happened to Johannes earlier, right? Yeah.
Right. So he's waiting for the Ethiopian army to basically disband from hunger or lack of supplies. But your friend Francesco Crispi could not accept this semi-stalemate and specifically ordered Barrettieri to advance and to fight a battle. So a little under 20,000 Italians with 56 artillery pieces confronted the Ethiopian army somewhere between 70 and 120,000 men. I realize that's very vague, but I guess the Europeans weren't very good at counting unless they won.
Yeah.
But that battle was A, decisive, and B, shocking.
Yeah, shocking. There's an Italian poem. I don't fully understand the poem, but it was an epigraph for one of Harold Marcus's chapters. It goes like this. What kinds of fools are there in Europe? Do they make their weapons of death and give them to us? With guns they have brought, with cartridges they have brought, Menelik has roasted and exploded the foreign barley. I don't know.
But the Italians lost about 7,000 killed, 1,500 wounded, and during their retreat back to Eritrea, they lost another 3,000 taken prisoner. Ethiopian losses, 4,000 killed, maybe 8,000 wounded. Included in the prisoners were 2,000 Eritrean soldiers. They were called Ascaris. They're fighting on the Italian side. So the Italian prisoners were treated pretty well under difficult circumstances, but 800 of the Ascaris, they were regarded as traitors by the Ethiopians, and they had their right hand and left foot amputated.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah. Menelik decided to be generous, though, or magnanimous to the Italians, and treated his Italian prisoners fairly well. Yeah, the resulting treaty with Italy changes that relationship significantly. And this is a humiliating defeat for Italy on so many levels, but especially on the racial level.
Yeah. So
right after all our episodes on scientific racism and, you know, the white man's burden and all of this stuff.
So you know what they do? They try to make it seem like Ethiopians and certainly Menelik aren't black.
Right.
So if you look at like even the official picture that you look on Wikipedia of Menelik II, the picture, they did something to the picture so he doesn't look black.
Yep. Oh, they go back to the Bible.
Yeah,
Solomon and the Queen of Sheba to say that, okay, the Ethiopians are an ancient people. And, oh, hey, wait, they're Christian, right?
Yeah.
So, and then look really closely. They're not, like, as black. They're kind of like white Africans.
And then you take...
you get this theory that the Ethiopians are somehow... like white immigrants from the ancient world who settled in Africa and, you know, kept their Christianity. So obviously they are super Africans.
And then they take the black and white photo and they wash it out so that it looks like he's white.
Yep.
I think I'm going to use that as the art for this episode. I'm going to show like other pictures of him because there are pictures of him that aren't like this, but presumably this is the one that they used.
Yeah, so the facts are that an African army, an African country, defeated a European country, which, according to scientific racism, is not possible. So how do we deal with this, you know, it's like an object falling upwards. It challenges the whole theory of gravity. So how do we explain this anomaly? And the explanation is the Ethiopians are actually kind of white. I mean, obviously they're kind of like at the bottom of the white,
right.
You know, table, but, and then they take another approach, which is even more humiliating for the Italians. They come up with an Italian racial theory, and then now they go back in history and they go, oh, remember when Sicily and Southern Italy were actually, you know, occupied by Muslims from North Africa? And notice how like the Italians have this history of being dominated by foreign power. So the Italians are kind of like racial mongrels. They're kind of not fully white.
This is so pathetic.
But it's also incredibly embarrassing for all of these Italian ultra imperialists. You know, they've not only lost the war, but now they're being racially shamed.
Mm-hmm.
Oh boy, that's gonna leave a mark.
So yeah, Menelik, you know, from the next, we'll pick up Menelik's story sometime, but in 1896 he goes on and rules until 1913, and he's a modernizer. He's building a railway. He's he's getting his tax revenues in order. He's making local administrators give a full accounting. He's institutes an appeal system so courts can appeal to the central government over the heads of the local authorities. So.
And this is why when the scramble for Africa is over, there's one notable exception, and Ethiopia is still independent.